Ecclesiastes Part 1 that Sunday in June. Well, we're beginning a brand new series in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you've ever struggled with the bigger, deeper, more significant questions of life, if you've ever wondered about meaning and existence and purpose and living a life that's meaningful, and I really think that's every single one of us at different times, then I really do want to encourage you and say that Ecclesiastes has lots to offer you. Also, as we get started, I want to recognize the diversity that exists here in this place, in this room today, where there are people here this morning worshiping together who could quote me verses from Ecclesiastes. And there are others who aren't even sure that Ecclesiastes is in the Bible, that you might have thought that was some kind of weird medical condition, or that you knew maybe that The Byrds, a rock band from the 60s, wrote a song from Ecclesiastes, but that might be about it. So I want to respect that and come at things really from the ground floor as we prepare to spend our time in these summer months making our way through the book of Ecclesiastes. So some very preliminary things to cover. Your Bible is divided in two parts, Old and New Testaments. And even within the different testaments, there's lots of different types of literature in them. Did you know that? You've got history and genealogy and letters and poetry and songs and gospels and even sections of the Bible about the apocalypse, about the end of time and end of days. It's all there. And in the Old Testament, there's a group of books called wisdom literature or wisdom books. And to make it even more convenient, they're actually grouped together. So in the Old Testament, when you hit that part of the Old Testament where you find Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, it's those five books that make up the section called the wisdom books or wisdom literature. And here's what's especially great about these five books. Traditionally, these books of the wisdom literature are known for that title because of their emphasis on understanding and attaining wisdom for all areas of life, including our relationships with God and with each other. They're not really at all historically concerned in that way, but instead they are theological, philosophical, and eminently practical. So very many people, when they come to reading the Old Testament, they seem to get overwhelmed sometimes with sections of the Old Testament that deal with this person or this king or this historical setting or this battle, and this person had this son, and this nation was invaded, and this king was in power, etc., etc. In fact, it's often in the historical sections of the Bible where if you've got great intentions at the first of the year that you're going to read the Bible this year or you're in a reading plan, it's often in those historical sections where the reading plan dies or we get really discouraged. But the wisdom books are very different, and each of them have their own unique thing going on because they're timeless. They speak to the human condition. They're always relevant. Proverbs talks so much about a great many things, but especially how you find success, how you avoid common pitfalls. It talks about money and relationships and character and business and home and marriage, all of these types of things. Psalms, the longest, largest section of the scripture, mostly attributed to King David, is all over the map with royal psalms and psalms of ascent, psalms of lament, psalms of praise, psalms of reflection, psalms that are inherently corporate, we might say, for the community, other psalms that are just so incredibly intimate and personal. The Song of Songs, the next book of the wisdom literature, is a celebration of sexuality, quite honestly. That's poetic, even graphic in spots and in its own way. And here it is in this section called the wisdom literature. In fact, young boys, young Hebrew boys, traditionally are often forbidden to read this book of Song of Songs until they're much older. And then we come to the book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's been said that these two books form more or less one lesson together, we might say, from both sides of the spectrum. So in the book of Job, we read of this man named Job, his struggle and his hardship. He is the man that finds favor with God, that he is kind of upright and just in all that he does. He's a righteous guy, loves God, follows God, and seeks to live for God. And he's blessed in every way. He's prosperous with money and business and family, even his herds and cattle and land, and on it goes. And basically, Job's life takes a sharp turn when the tempter, the accuser, the tester, some would even say Satan, comes to God and says, you know what? He won't be so religious. He won't be so happy to worship you and follow you if you take away his stuff. And to save a long story short, sort of systematically, Job is kind of stripped bare of what he has in his life with his blessings, to the point where finally and lastly, his success, even his family are taken from him, and he is left with nothing. And the tail end of that whole season of Job's life, it ends with basically, give me his health, and he will curse you, says the tempter. And God allows it, and Job is stricken, and in ashes, completely poor, dogs licking his wounds, we find Job, and he arrives at the space where he says, we have no hope on earth. The only hope we have is beyond the sun. And most of us haven't experienced that season or that day in our lives when absolutely everything is taken from us. Everything, including our health. Most of us haven't experienced that day in our lives, but we often experience struggle and suffering and hardship. And we will have people whose lives have that sense somehow that they're perpetually disadvantaged, that the deck is stacked against them, and that's the cause of their setbacks somehow. If only I had this opportunity or this chance or better education, or I had better opportunities or better doors were opened for me, or if I had a better spouse or a better family, and on and on. And they'll create this thing that exists somewhere out there over the rainbow, so to speak. But the problem with that kind of thinking that somehow I'm living a life of deprivation and that's the cause of my struggle, the problem with that kind of thinking is the book of Ecclesiastes. Because we have in Ecclesiastes, what we find is that one person who, unlike Job, had everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. Relationship, success, money, affluence, power, fame, education, opportunity. Nothing at all held back from him. He had everything, but it still did not suffice. Well, let's start reading Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. These are the words of the teacher, King David's son, who ruled in Jerusalem. Now, in the New Testament, the word ecclesia is used as a title for God's assembled people. In other words, the church. Ecclesiastes, this book of the Bible, the title for it, literally means the leader of the assembly, and has been given some English equivalents as we translate that word, including the teacher, the president, the leader, the speaker, the professor, the pundit. So through the book of Ecclesiastes, this is more than just a life story, more than just a biographical sketch, which it certainly is. But here we find the teacher really wanting to teach something significant that he is learning. He describes himself as King David's son who ruled in Jerusalem. And specifically, this is King Solomon, who lived and ruled in the 10th century B.C., thereabouts 900 to 1,000 years before Jesus was born. So the teacher is the king of a very prosperous and wealthy and powerful nation. This is the nation of Israel. As such, he has more wealth, more power, more fame, more affluence than you or I are likely to ever experience. You see, from the moment that he was born, he had privilege, he had opportunity, he had pedigree and education and even grooming, we might say, in such a way that few, if any, before or since have ever experienced, completely beyond anything we'll ever know. In fact, in 1 Kings chapter 3, we read that Solomon, as a brand new, young, inexperienced king, following in his father's footsteps, King David, he is acutely aware of his limitations, aware of his shortcomings, aware of his youth and inexperience. The Lord speaks to Solomon in a dream one night and asks him, basically, I'll give you anything that you want, God says in this dream. So be free to ask it of me. And do you know what Solomon asks for? Of all of the things that he would ever request from the Lord, here's what he asks for. Wisdom. Wisdom. He asks that the Lord would make him wise. So God is immeasurably pleased at this request, and the response that comes is this: I will make you wiser than anyone who has ever lived or ever will live. And yet we read from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, here in verse 2, everything is meaningless, says the teacher, completely meaningless. Some of your translations will say vanity of vanities. Life is meaningless, even pointless. Everything is meaningless, everything. Well, what about success and intellect and marriage and pleasure and wealth and talent, possessions? Everything meaningless. And through these 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes, we encounter this phrase, this word, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. We find it no less than 38 times through 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes. Well, why is everything meaningless? We carry on in verse 3. The teacher says, what do people get for all their hard work under the sun? And we're going to hear him talk about this throughout the book. But the gist is this: we will be born, we'll live, we'll do some stuff, and at the end of the day, everything remains the same. We won't change the world, and one day we will die, and they'll have a nice service for us, hopefully, and things will carry on very nicely in our absence, and that will be that. When at the end of the day, at the end of our lives, what have we actually done? What significance have our lives really had? There's a philosophy called empiricism that deals with this. Basically says that all knowledge is derived from sense experience. That is, everything that we know and experience is derived from the five senses. That is, if we can't hear it, taste it, see it, smell it, touch it, then it's insignificant. So that unless we can measure just how in some way our lives really are significant, if we can't quantify that somehow, then our lives are just not significant. And here's what the teacher goes on to say to us. And I think you can catch the picture that's being painted here. What do people get for all their hard work under the sun? Generations come, generations go. I'm reading in verse 4. But the earth never changes. The sun rises, the sun sets, and then hurries around to rise again. The wind blows south, and then turns north, around and around it goes, blowing in circles. Rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. Then the water returns again to the rivers and flows out again to the sea. Everything is wearisome beyond description. No matter how much we see, we are never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we are not content. Now, we live in a wonderful part of the world to catch this, don't we? Rivers and ponds and lakes and the ocean. We see the tide comes in, the tide goes out. Crops grow and they get harvested. Then winter comes and then spring and they're planted all over again. The wind blows boy, does the wind blow here in PEI. It blows in one direction and then another and then back around again. At the end of the day, the picture that we have painted here for us from the teacher is that of a wheel, a treadmill. You run and run and run. You exert yourself to the point of fainting, and really, how far have you gone? At the end of the day, you've gone nowhere. And the days and months and years seem to come and go in a predictable rhythm, and there you are. Sometimes I can find myself relating deeply to these kinds of thoughts of the seasons and things being circular, and where I can think, well, 40 more times that I'll decorate a Christmas tree, or 40 more October turkeys I'll cook, if I'm lucky, that'll pretty much be that, and I'll be all done. I keep mowing my lawn, and it grows back. I pay the bills, but the bills keep coming. The laundry baskets get full again. It just seems as soon as you empty them, then the recycling bin no sooner gets sorted and emptied, and it's full again. Have you ever lost track of what day it is? And I suppose what I mean is how one day can bleed into the next. And it's probably a good thing that we have phones and technology to remind us, but this is not new. The alarm clock goes off, you get up. Maybe you eat a similar thing every morning, wear similar clothes, go through the routine, get out the door, go to work in the same place with perhaps the same people, eat lunch at the same time, have an afternoon coffee, finish up, head home, do what you need to, eat dinner, prepare yourself for the next day, go to bed. And guess what it is that you're very likely to do tomorrow? The same thing. Verse 9 says, history merely repeats itself. It's all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. Sometimes people say, here is something new, but actually it's old. Nothing is ever truly new. And this requires really very little commentary. All of life for everyone, for all time, is like that. A wheel, a cycle, a treadmill, where history repeats itself again and again. There is nothing new under the sun. And the absolutely crazy thing that we do as human beings perpetually is to fall into the trap to believe that there really are new things, new toys, new trinkets, new tricks, new activities, when we actually know on the other side of those things that they're really not that new, but probably just old things repackaged. And here's the weird thing. A new gadget, a new car, a new phone, new clothes, new vacation, whatever it might be, has this weird emotional effect upon us. Maybe a wonderful distraction, a wonderful elevation that seems to thrill our souls in this really odd way that I think is just temporary to distract us from the mundane that Ecclesiastes talks about exactly in this way. Did you know that there's unboxing videos online for just about anything that you can think of? Were you aware of that? Like, think of any item, any product, any, doesn't even have to be technological device, what have you. There's unboxing videos, thousands upon thousands of them, that you can watch. And the whole idea being is that we have this absolute thrill of new things, of even opening them and taking them out of their box, to the point that if we were actually hooked up and monitored physiologically, we would see a measurable response that happens within our neurological system, within our body, in response to opening up a package with a new thing. Isn't that crazy? But what happens with every single one of those new things? And what always happens to the new thing? Whatever it is, the new house, the new car, the new vacation, the new relationship, the new lawnmower, new clothes, new phone, new job, whatever it is, they all get old. They get a scratch. It takes a ding. It flat out breaks. It gets old. And the dumb thing is, we know that to be true. Sometimes people say, here's something new, but actually it's old. Nothing is ever truly new, says the teacher. Nothing is new. It's all been done, we could say. And even in terms of our lives themselves and how we live them, we might think, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to make a lasting difference. I will leave my mark. The world will be fundamentally a different place because I resided in it for my lifetime. And people will reflect on my legacy for centuries to follow. Maybe we don't think exactly in those terms, but to be sure, to a degree, we certainly do. Here's what the teacher says. Nope, not true. Verse 11, we don't remember what happened in the past, and in future generations, no one will remember what we're doing now. I'm a fortunate one in the sense that my aunt, who was a real genealogist type, she actually went ahead and put together a super comprehensive family tree that went back almost 500 years. Amazing work and time that she put into all of this. And I've read through it, skimmed through it on occasion. And guess what? I still could not tell you offhand my great-great-grandfather's name. And then the teacher honestly flexes some muscle on the reader, hearer, when he highlights his credentials in the midst of his search for meaning. It's kind of like he's pointing out, oh yeah, just in case you've forgotten, let me remind you who I am again. I've got more wisdom than you. I've got more power than you, more wealth. I've had more women, more experiences than you, more education than you. So I'm that guy that you can trust on this journey. Verse 12, I, teacher, was king of Israel, and I lived in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to search for understanding, to explore by wisdom everything being done under heaven, and I soon discovered that God has dealt a tragic existence to the human race. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really, it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. What is wrong cannot be made right. What is missing cannot be recovered. So I said to myself, look, I am wiser than any of the kings who ruled in Jerusalem before me. I have greater wisdom and knowledge than any of them. Verse 17, so I set out to learn everything from wisdom to madness and folly, but I learned firsthand. Pursuing all of this is like chasing the wind. This is the equivalent of saying, I've got both extremes. I've lived highbrow and I've lived lowbrow. I've been there, I've done that. And here's a super important point in all of this. Meaning, purpose is neither up here nor down there. Because our world sends as the two predominant messages, which by are keeping with Ecclesiastes, and these are not new either. First, the world tells us, I need more. If I only had more, if I only had extra, if I only got this break, if I only had this opportunity, if I only had this door, if I only got discovered by this person, whatever it is, more, I just need more. The second message that our world sends to us again and again is interesting because it's the opposite. It's this: if life was just simpler, if it was less complicated, less complex, uncluttered a bit more. And by the way, this philosophy, kind of a lifestyle of minimalism, is massively, massively popular. There are TED Talks. There are Netflix original series. There are books and blogs and podcasts all speaking to it. And here is the teacher who's saying, I've done them both. I've done it all. Excess or little, complicated or simple, maximized or minimized, I'll just save you all of the searching and cut to the end of the journey. I've done it for you. Here's the landing spot. All meaningless. Verse 18. The greater my wisdom, the greater my grief. To increase knowledge, only increases sorrow. All right, let's pray. No, that's a terrible spot to land. That would be such a wanting place to park things. What a terrible message that would be just on its own. But seriously, what a bleak picture. What a dark commentary, an indictment on life and the human condition within it. Wow, this is in the Bible? I thought I'd come to church for some sense of hope and encouragement. What's this all about? Maybe you're thinking, if this is the flavor of the summer series, then I'm just sleeping in and going golfing till September, seriously. But what do we do with all of this? Because I think the book that portrays the pointlessness of everything really does have a point to make. How do I even start applying this wisdom literature, this Ecclesiastes stuff to my life? Is this just meant to make me feel worse or ruin what little fun I used to have with my gadgets and my trinkets? I think here's where we really dial things in. Until we are ready before the Lord to honestly evaluate life under the sun and really examine your own life and what real meaning or lack of meaning that's there, this is what you're stuck with. Everything is meaningless. But when you're ready to slow down and look, that is the beginning of the development of something beyond just our five senses, the things that we can empirically measure. And that something that gets formed within us as we slow down, as we reflect, as we look up, that's something that's far beyond just the horizontal plane, that's beyond just our senses, the Bible simply calls faith. That's it. And it has the power to take us beyond, just like under the sun, but beyond that to spiritually rise above the treadmill and the hamster wheel as we, in one sense, look within, but out of that we look up for something greater beyond just ourselves and beyond just what this life can afford us. I love how one author puts this around what Ecclesiastes is for. They write this, "Primarily, it acts as a foil or contrast to the other books. It is a brilliant, artful argument for the way one would look at life if God did not play a direct intervening role in life and if there were no life after death." So if you're picking up on a pretty pronounced downer, melancholy note here at play and you think, well, what's up with that? This is the point that's being drawn out, that we are just on a wheel. We do repeat the same thing day in, day out. Our lives will not be significant. No one will remember our names once we're gone. And yes, everything is meaningless were it not for the opportunity to allow God to play the central role in our lives. The central message of the book of Ecclesiastes is that when we settle for just this, what's in front of us, this is what we will get. And nothing will ever satisfy you. Relationships, money, food, power, sex, trinkets, fame. And who's better to trust in all of this, to trust their teaching, than someone who's gone before and who's experienced it all? As such, there are two types of people in the world. There are those who will remain deceived and preoccupied with the trinkets and satiated with those things. And there are those who will look past what's just under the sun. And the tragic thing in all of this is that there are many who never, ever, ever will. And they will choose to live in vain, and they will die in vain, and they will face a purposeless and meaningless eternity. But But then there are those who will not settle for a meaningless existence, for whom God is stirring within them, and they respond. And when all of this stuff, and a bit of this charade gets lifted from our eyes, we can be free from the treadmill and the wheel, and the Lord is able to remove the futility from our lives that will otherwise see us amused to death. Because everything else under the sun is just spinning on a wheel. And jumping even for a moment across from the Old Testament to the New Testament, we read God's plan for our lives as spoken to us by Jesus, his Son. What is God's desire for us? Jesus says, "My purpose is to give them," that is those who put their faith and their trust and hope in him, "My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life, not just purposelessness, not a life that's meaningless, not any of those things at all." Maybe you relate so deeply with the words of the teacher and you feel like you've discovered many of these same things. You wonder if life really is meaningless. Know that apart from God, it's true. And yet with God at the center, there is a life that awaits you that can be rich and satisfying and have incredible meaning, that most importantly has eternal significance, all through knowing him, our Creator and our God. Let's pray about all of that as we close this morning.